Welcome to Season 2 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we're going to have a quick intro because we don't have much news. Then we're going to do a quick overview and review of the AGOT 2.0 core set. We're not going to go through cards or anything. It's more just general impressions. Then we're going to have a little bit of deck building in 2.0 and then some closing comments.
This is episode 28, John, and normally I'd like to start off by telling people all the results that happened over the weekend. These big national champions, the Flea Bottom Fracas, the Nordic Nationals, the Canadian Nationals. Actually, I wouldn't like to tell you about Canadian Nationals.
Yeah, we don't need to talk about that. It's depressing.
But I can't. Any idea why I can't?
Because they're all this coming week.
Yeah, we're recording fairly far in advance, which is rare for us. But I'm actually out of town for about a week. And this is the only time that we could slot this in. Obviously, as you've noticed, this episode has gone up on time. The fact that I'm saying this 5 days before I get it up is, you know, irrelevant.
Because of the magic of the internet?
It's the magic of the internet. So we don't have a whole bunch of news to go over since this is basically 2 days after our last podcast went up. I do have a few small things. Do you have anything for us, though?
Sadly, no. Again, for the same reason that you don't.
I did want to mention that at the very least, there seems to be some official or more moving forces that are suggesting that the game will be released in August, that seem to be slightly more official sources closer to FFG, which is encouraging. And that we managed to get, with the help of Christian Savda from Chile, the pictures of all of the playmats that they released at Gen Con. So those will have been added to our Facebook page on Tuesday, ages before you listen to this, ages before you listen to this. The pictures don't quite do them justice. The colors were very, very vibrant, especially the Stark and Tyrell ones really stood out to me. But at least you can get an idea. We don't know whether these are going to be for sale. I imagine they must go for sale.
I would think so.
But they haven't been announced. They haven't been posted in the products anywhere or anything of the sort. So,
but I would assume that they're going to go up for sale, look very special. People will buy them because, you know, they're nice. Or maybe they'll be tournament prizes. That'd be cool.
All right. Well, that's then everything we have. We'll jump right into what is going to be a rather lengthy episode. Just to start us off, so we're going to be reviewing the 2.0 core set. Note, we're not going to be reviewing the 2.0 game. We're not going to be telling you much about the mechanics, about how the theme fits in, about how individual cards' power level. We're going to be talking about this new product that they've launched and how it meets our expectations. So, John, it's finally here. I am currently actually playing with physical cards from the Game of Thrones second edition, The Card Game. And something that I actually haven't seen anyone do yet is review the game. Tell people whether they should buy it. Obviously, you know, we're somewhat biased, but maybe we can take a look at the game in depth.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the game itself is mechanically way stronger than it was in its original format. I think the rules have been
let's assume that there are a lot of new players. Tell us a little bit about the history of the Game of Thrones card game and very briefly, why a reboot? Why a second edition?
Why a third reboot?
Why a third reboot? There you go. Tell people that this is a third reboot.
I mean, Game of Thrones started as a collectible card game, and it had a pretty good success at the time because it was a collectible card game that was making money. And when you were competing with things like Magic and Legend of the Five Rings, if you made money, you did well, and if you didn't close down in the first year. And Game of Thrones had an interesting mechanic, which is one of the big selling points to me, which is the plot mechanic. And the plot mechanic allows you to control basically your resources in any given round by choosing a plot that has a gold value. And it has a bunch of other effects. But this mechanic and the plot game, and I'm putting like air quotes here, that people talk about a lot around Game of Thrones, I think led to its success as a CCG. But it wasn't quite successful enough. FFG had not as much success with some of their other card games. They moved to a new format that I think they actually trademarked living card games. And they were the first company that I know of that did this living card game type approach, where there was no more chase cards. There was no more random booster packs. You always knew, and everyone was on this equal playing field. And Game of Thrones, a couple years after, I think Cthulhu was the first one, I believe, that moved to this new format. A year or a year and a half after Cthulhu, Game of Thrones moved to this new format and did a reboot. And there was a lot of players that were unhappy with the reboot because they actually enjoyed the chase cards. They actually enjoyed where the game was. They thought it had great mechanics, and they weren't very happy, so they left. But strangely enough, a year later, these people that left all started coming back because they realized that the game had even gotten better. And that game was the game that's kind of in its final swan song now this year. It's the game that's ended, but it's also a game that people have really enjoyed. It's probably in one of the best places it's ever been, but the company that produces it realized that there's just no way they could sustain the card pool for new players, because the barrier of entry to purchase all those cards, because there was never going to be rotation, as well as learn all these rules, was just way too much to expect. So they decided, I think rightly so, to reboot the game that I love, and I think you love too, Alex, to this new edition, so that it'd be easier for new players. They could clean up the rules at the same time. They could introduce some interesting new mechanics. And I think they did all that with this new product.
Now, let's not give them hope. Wholly altruistic motives. I mean, I'm a huge fan of their decision to reboot. We obviously were very involved in the rules of the first edition, or I was specifically, and those were, there were artifacts in there dating from problems that the game had experienced in 2002 when they didn't know what they were doing, where they were just founding the game. So there was a lot of sort of the legacy rulings that you had to know to make the game work, and a backlog of 2,200-ish cards that were playable in a tournament scene. There were a lot of very good reasons to reboot, and I wholeheartedly agree with their decision to reboot. But I think one of the biggest factors allowing them to do this is the popularity of the HBO show.
Yeah, they want to make money.
And they want to make money off that, and they needed a product that is accessible. And that's great for us as players, because as the community grows, that's what we want. But I think that if they didn't have that pressure of knowing the market could be much, much bigger than it was, we would not have got this reboot.
Yeah, I agree.
You touched on what an LCG is. The format functionally means that whenever you buy a product like this core set, they're going to release constant expansions. And these expansions can be in the form of deluxe boxes, which will have some 55 cards and about 3 copies of each. It can be in chapter packs, which are released in 20 cards and 3 copies of each, so that's a 60-card pack on a roughly monthly basis. But those cards are fixed. You know exactly what cards are in there, and you get a full play set of them right now. There's one exception to that, and we'll get into that later, but it does mean that it's not the person who spent the most money who has the best deck, necessarily, and that if you need a specific card, you know exactly where to find it. You don't need to, as you said, chase down rares or work through that kind of stuff.
Trade for it or anything like that. And that's one of the nice parts about this. A lot of these collectible card games are pretty expensive, and I'm not saying that Game of Thrones is cheap. You're still buying that $15 or $20 chapter pack once a month. But, if all you're investing is $20 or $15 a month or whatever it is, $12.99, it's not as large of a financial burden for a lot of people as having to put down $300 every couple months on the newest set of Magic.
And you can scratch your collector's itch and, catch them all for a price under, thousands and thousands of dollars. So the starting point then, what they launched at Gen Con this year and that in theory should be coming out in, I've heard, August officially from even North American retailers now, so it does look like it's going to be August, is this new $40 box with 234 cards.
Yep.
And so this is unlike the first edition. This is a smaller format box. It's the same format as their Conquest core box, which does mean it's not a great storage solution for your cards. It's not deep enough to store your cards specifically in it, although you can buy inserts and do all sorts of things with it. I don't store my cards in the box anyway, so for me that's not a big deal. But the product itself, then, is... I'm opening the box, as you can hear, hopefully. It greets you with components of sort of the usual Fantasy Flight quality. If you have played any Fantasy Flight games before, you know that they're generally known for having a very nice art on their components and, you know, tokens and things like that that are quite playable and quite evocative of the scene. And that's the first thing that greets you, is aside from a little catalog of apparently their products from last winter. They didn't get a chance to update that. And two magnificent rule books, which we'll talk about later. You get the gold tokens.
Of course, the rule books had to be magnificent.
They do, of course. I was involved in them. You get 30 gold tokens, you get 30 power tokens, and I believe you get 10 influence tokens, which is new, and a first player token. So I before we get into the cards, I did want to mention the rule books, obviously. As I mentioned, I was involved in the creation of these rule books, so I have a special place in my heart for them. But we mentioned that the rules were an issue in the initial game. So a large part of what went into this game is streamlining the rules and making them more approachable. That generally, in my experience so far, hasn't meant changing the game. It hasn't really meant, okay, deciding that some of the key aspects of the old game just weren't going to work, couldn't be simplified, and had to be scrapped. I think it mostly meant, in a lot of cases, making it a little more approachable, making it more intuitive, and in many cases, making it play out the way that people thought it was played in the first edition.
People play the way people were playing in the first edition until they went to a tournament and then found out they've been playing wrong the whole time because of rule X, Y, or Z.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's things like Moribund, which we won't go into details of that. That's things like the Declaration of Stealth, which is a key word involved in the game, that a lot of people were doing at the wrong time. They've now been moved to match what people were expecting, what people were doing. So for veterans, there's some things to get used to. But for people coming into the game at a new point, it should be a lot easier to grasp, especially if you've played some of their other LCGs, because a lot of the terminology is the same. And they've actually broken down the rules in the same way they have in Conquest, their newest LCG, and that's it, breaking it down into a learn-to-play guide and a rules reference.
I think that's great, because having a learn-to-play guide for new players makes things so much easier. And you could see that actually at Gen Con, where they held this for the first ever tournament of 2.0, and it was kind of like a learn-to-play event in some ways. And I saw people actually that had that learn-to-play guide out, and they were using that as kind of a reference guide while they were learning the game, and the person across from them was also learning the game in some cases. So it was interesting to see that people were actually using that document.
A couple of nice things about this learn-to-play guide is the very last page has a sort of reference chart. It has the phase sequence. It has all the keywords, which are elements on cards that aren't always explained by rules text because they're relatively common. So, for instance, cards might have the text renown written on them, but you don't know what that means. So you look it up. It's a keyword, and it tells you on the back of the sheet that that means that after you win a challenge in which this character is participating, you may gain a power on that character.
That was the specific part of the rules I saw most people looking at.
Yeah, and it also has something that I always thought was quite interesting. In first edition, the symbols for the houses look different when they were in text rather than the symbol for the house in other places. So a lot of people didn't know what the small wolf was because it didn't really look like a wolf. And here they actually tell you what the symbol looks like in all the cards and things like that as well. One of the changes that people may notice from first edition is that the military symbol no longer looks like an axe. It looks like a sword. Moderately interesting story behind that is that it turns out that a remarkable number of people, when I was teaching them at least, the first game, would ask why there was a bat challenge, that the axe looked like the bat. So now I guess maybe people might say a cross challenge, but I think it looks like a sword. I think it's pretty clear.
That was an axe in First Ed?
It was an axe. You didn't know it was an axe?
I didn't know what it was. It was the Red Challenge, Alex. Yeah, the Red Challenge.
I'd heard, Red Challenge. I'd heard Bat Challenge. I'd heard Batman Challenge, actually. So that's been avoided. The Learn to Play guide, though, that's where you want to start. That if you try and open the rules reference and you try and read that one as a rules, you know, guide that'll teach you how to play the game, the very first thing you see is this halt box that tells you, read the Learn to Play book first. As questions arise in gameplay, then you can look at specific entries in here. After you've played a couple games, check out the timing charts at the end of this. And I think that advice is meant to be taken seriously. The rules reference is a very technical document. And right. I appreciate that. I really do. As a sort of rules lawyer kind of person, this document does a great job of laying a foundation for all sorts of tricky rules questions that come down the road. But if you give this to a new player and they start reading, after the first page, they will have no idea what's going on. I think that's probably a drawback to it. Thankfully, it does have that halt. I think the Learn to Play guide is very good as an introduction. But I'd say that there are some flaws to this rules reference guide. I happen to know why. But if I had to criticize it, I would say that it doesn't have examples. And those are space constraints, and I can understand the reasoning, but there are quite a few situations in which an example might have made the very technical language much clearer to new players and old players alike. And sometimes you can get lost in the technical, very, very precise language that's used in the guide.
Yeah, I didn't read that guide.
You didn't read that guide. You just trust me to
yes, exactly.
To go through it.
I figured you'd get it when we played. You'd correct me, and then I'd be on track after that.
That's right. Now, I guess we can move on to the idea behind the cards. I think it's important to note, though, that this box is trying to be a lot of things to a lot of different people, and it succeeds to varying degrees. I mean, the Game of Thrones game can be played as a joust game, which is a one-versus-one match, and so the box obviously has to contain decks to teach in that way. It's slightly simpler to teach a joust because there are fewer different players at the board and fewer things to keep track of.
So less rules, too, right?
Slightly fewer rules. But it has to be able to support the melee game, which is that 3-to-6 player game now. So it has to be to have cards that interact with that format. It has to be a great introduction to the game. You have to be able to buy a single box and get a good idea for what the game is, but it has to feel somewhat incomplete because they obviously want you to buy more cards. They want you to buy the next expansion. They might want you to buy a second deluxe box. It also has to appeal to people who want all 8 factions, which is something rather difficult for it to do. And it has to appeal to the existing player base, which is used to a card base of more than 2,000 cards, and we're getting cut back down to, you know, 200 and some. So I think it has a lot of niches to fill. As both a tutorial, as an introductory experience, and at the higher level as a deck building experience. And I'd say there are some hits and misses in there.
You miss some key things too. This is the first time that new players and old players are going to be introduced to these new factions. And this box set needs to define those factions in some way so that you know, Stark is the house that kills things and Barra is the house that does soft control with Neil or et cetera. And those personalities have to come through from this box
in a very small set of cards. Yeah.
So that's not easy to do either.
So of those things, what do you think they succeeded at before we get in the ones that I think that they may have slipped a little on?
I think that most of the houses, and I'll say 2/3 of the houses, did get that sense of purpose that I kind of have an idea of what the house is about. I think Greyjoy came very strongly through with their power grab, their unopposed. I felt that. I think Baratheon came through as the house that's about soft control and Neil and power challenge. I felt that that came through. I think Tyrell came through with the house that strength matters, you know, where they have strength pumps and those pumps do more than just pump them. They actually, you know, stand their characters or have secondary effects. So I think that came through too. And I even feel that Tyrell got a little bit of flavor of control, which was great because for me, that's a Nedley thing. That Queen of Thorns, in both the book and the show, is always scheming in the background and having some control. And they have that with Highgarden, so they have this kind of like little bit of control element, you know. And I felt that Lannister represents its gold very well. sadly, I don't feel like the Stark had, it didn't hit me with a defined characteristic. I didn't feel that they were any stronger in military challenges than non-kneeling Jaime out of Lannister or Khal Drogo, who gives extra military challenges in Targ. And Targ seems to be a little all over the map. It's got some burn. It's got this kind of module that's centered around Daenerys Targaryen. It's got this military module with Khal Drogo and the Braided Warriors. It just it's got some attachment control in Viserys. It just seems to be so spotty in so many different places. You know, it's got the stand tech, and I feel like it's because it's everywhere, it's undefined.
I do want to argue a little bit. I do think Targ does a pretty good job of telling you that Targ is all about Daenerys right now. I mean,
we're going to build a deck on this cast that doesn't even use her.
I know, but the impression that you get when you open those Targ cards is you see this amazing Dany, you see that the dragons work with her, you see that the burn works with her, you see that the stand module works with Dany, and so you see a faction about a centerpiece. Now, the faction has more to it than just that centerpiece, but I think as a new player, you see that centerpiece and you see an item.
Okay, maybe my issue is that I don't think a faction should have, like, all the other factions have a theme, and you're telling me the theme of Targaryen is all about Dany?
Yeah, I think that might be a mistake in the long run, and that's why they have to diversify later. But for the theme within the core to be all about Dany, I mean, what are people playing Targ for if they're coming from the HBO show or new to the game? Yeah. I think it's Dany.
Dragons and Dany. Sure.
And I think that's fine.
I think that's not a theme. That's a centerpiece, and I think that's a mistake. I think you're proving my point that Targ doesn't have a theme. What it has is a centerpiece.
Okay. All right.
I think it has some personality, but I don't feel like it has a solid theme yet. Unless the theme ongoing is going to be all about Dany, and like, I don't think FFG is going to do that. I agree with you. I think that would be. Exactly.
I actually think that Night's Watch does a reasonable job of theme as well. Of being about that defense. Now, whether that works in the sort of larger environment in the long term, we don't really know yet. But I do feel that theme is mostly captured by all but sort of Jon Snow and Ghost, which are the outliers. And I don't think that's necessarily a problem.
I can see their theme. I think you're right. I just don't feel like it was – it's not their strength.
That I can see.
I don't like Old Bear Mormont. Yeah, I don't like him at all.
I mean, whether you like him or not, I still think he's obviously – you look at your 7-cost character and you go, oh, I know what the theme that they've put into this was.
It's Stark and Targaryen that are the two that I find are the least theme-centered. And Nightwatch, I can see that they're going for a theme. I just don't think they did it well.
I would say that Martell, I also can very much see the theme they're going for. I think it just falls long a little game. Bit short. It falls a little bit short of paying off right now.
It's like Nightwatch.
Yeah.
Their two themes both seem to be there, just they fall short. So I hope that they don't forget these themes, that they don't forget a niche that each faction has, because these factions need a niche, or why even have another faction? Right, so it's super important, I think, for FFG to continue with these themes and push them in the next, you know, 3-4 cycles, so that we see the Night's Watch defense theme, the Martell long game plan theme come out and actually become useful and a way to win.
I did want to say, and I don't know exactly how this fits in, but there is one thing that I feel that this core does exceptionally well. First of all, it was some of the advantages we have is that this was clearly designed with rotation in mind. It's a series of evergreen cards. It's a series of foundational cards that yet manage to be fairly interesting and in many cases very powerful. But I think that they also do a really great job of introducing you to mechanics, of seeding the card pool, of introducing you to some of the things that might matter. And I want to give an example of that, which is the card Naval Superiority. If you don't know it, this is a plot that specifically acts on plots with certain traits. Or, for instance, the Vanguard of the North, which is a character that doesn't kneel if the plot has a certain trait, the war trait. Normally, you could be playing this game in first edition and not realize that plot traits mattered at all.
Yeah, no trait. There's a whole bunch of traits that didn't matter at all in first edition.
And that's fine. But here, within the core environment, they're saying, hey, you know, this little thing that we added on the cards, this might matter. Take a look at it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other aspects like that. For instance, the Martell mechanic that counts the number of used plots in the pile that builds up over time. That is a sort of seed mechanic that they can do all sorts of neat things with in the future, and they've just given us this a couple of cards that work on that mechanic just to say, this is a space we can explore.
Mm-hmm.
There are entries in the rules reference that say things like a deck building limit of you know, cards can normally be only included three of, but if the deck building limit says two or less, then it's a restriction. You can only put two or so in, which is fine. But if it says four or more, that means you can put more of them in. There aren't any cards like that, but the mechanics are there to be able to expand this game in a lot of different ways. And I think that it does a really good job of making you play with the cards and realize how far this game can go, how far this game can grow. And I think that's a really good starting point for an LCG.
Yeah.
I think perhaps one of the most controversial things that comes up every time FFG releases a new product is this idea that the core set is has a lot of one-of cards and that it doesn't give you that much deck-building flexibility, not by tournament deck-building rules anyway. And so there's a lot of people that say, oh, you really need to buy a second core set, and a lot of people that believe and say, oh, you need to buy three core sets to get a full play set of every card. This has been sort of hashed ad nauseum. First of all, the decision that clearly went into this box was most cards would be one-ofs, and in fact, more so than any previous product, it looks like the decision was to keep cards one-ofs. The cards that are multiples of are cards that you need multiples of if you're going to build multiple decks. So the base economy cards and a couple of the neutrals that you expect to put into multiple decks. So that to me looks like a decision that was clearly aimed at veterans.
Yeah.
I can't fault them for that, because obviously one of the unique things about rebooting this game is that you get this base of veterans that you want to engage, that you want to use them as a springboard to build up the game to be a much, much larger community. But I can also see the objection that anybody coming from a board game or another system says when they go, what, I buy this and it has this fealty agenda that I can't even use because it's impossible to build a single faction deck out of one core. And for that, I feel like the experience is incomplete. And again, to some extent, they want the experience to feel incomplete. They want you to buy the next chapter pack, so that's forgivable. But I think it does mean that that a lot of people then feel like they're forced to buy three cores, especially in this environment where you can't just buy another two or three chapter packs to then build up to it.
But I really don't think they are. I mean, the Gen Con tournament showed us one thing, and that's that you can build some nice Joust decks right out of the core set and play them and have a great time. And I think with those modified rules they used at Gen Con, you could do a great melee, and you could easily have a three-player melee that would be enjoyable. You could probably easily have a four-player melee that would be enjoyable, and the decks would be fun and be reasonably balanced. It would definitely be worth playing.
I agree, and I think this is far more so than the first edition core, a much stronger entry point with a lot more, for instance, powerful cards, interesting cards, but also cards that you can tell what they're trying to do, decks that have a theme, unlike some of the ones from first edition, mm-hmm. and all of that is great. I do think that it does leave you with a few odd situations, like, for instance, the Learn to Play guide mentions the rules for duplicates. But in the single core, it is impossible to play a duplicate. There's no character that is duplicated. I think that is a bit of an odd thing out for them to do, and I think that that contrasts and does make the core, the single core experience, feel a little lacking, where you're going, well, I'm clearly missing out on something that is supposed to be in the game. And I can't fault them for that, because as a veteran player, obviously I want to have as many different cards as possible to start the game. The fact that I can buy three cores and I now have full play sets of 230-something cards means that instead of a core where all the cards were two ofs, where we'd have half as many cards in the total pool. And that's very important to me as a veteran player, but I can definitely see how that's off-putting to someone.
Well, I would think a new player would want that too. Like, a new player probably wants to see a game where they have as many options available to begin with as possible. You know, it's not a game that's overly complex to play, especially with the small card pool, but it's nice as you become more interested in the game to have more of these options. And I think that new players, after, you know, a month with the game, will appreciate the fact that FFG tried to get as many unique cards possible printed in this core.
I think that is a fair point, in that they did represent a lot of the different characters, and that is something that they might not be able to do if they were constraining themselves to two ups. So obviously, if you're playing Lannister, you want to see Tyrion, you want to see Tywin, you want to see Cersei, you want to see
Joffrey.
Right, and if you had to cut the number of cards by half, you might not see all of those favorite characters. So yeah. That is a case where they probably benefited that.
There'd be no Khal Drogo, you know, in the Targaryen, and how can you have Targaryen without a Khal Drogo? You know, he's pivotal in that first book. He's pivotal at the beginning of the show. I think he's an important character to see in the box set.
So, I guess I do want to close that little bit off by making a recommendation about what you should buy if you are interested in getting in this game. And for me, that recommendation is a single core set. And I'm obviously a deck builder. I own three core sets. But if you're not sure about the game, if you're just getting into it, a single core set offers you tutorial decks and a couple of decks you can swap around with. You can play around with the rules and ignore fealty restrictions to get a baseline experience. And if the core does its job, you're going to want to buy a second. But you don't need to start with that. And I think that once you have the second one, depending on how far into the card pool we are, if we have two or three chapter packs, those might be better buys than the third core. I don't think a lot of people needed a third core in first edition, even though a lot of people felt they did for single cards that they rarely played, that they felt they needed a full play set of. I think the value of getting a third core here is much better than any of the previous games because almost all the cards are singletons. So rather than the diminishing returns that you were getting in, say, Netrunner, where there were a lot of three of cards that you didn't even need a second core to get a full playset of,
right.
Here most of them you are. But my recommendation, if you're thinking of getting into this game, is to buy yourself a core set. And if after playing 10, 15 games or whatever it is that you'd like to play with your playgroup, you feel like you want that second core set, that's when you buy the second core set. And I think that's the right decision. The third core set, you may never need. If by then we're 3-4 months down the road and there are other cards available, you'll be able to flesh out your decks in other ways as well. And I think that's the smart way to approach this game.
Yeah, I totally agree. Right now, I only own one core set.
You wish you owned more, though.
No, I'm happy right now. Mostly because no one else around here has it because it hasn't been released.
That's true. You're the special one. Now let's talk about the components themselves. They've obviously the cards have undergone a graphic redesign. Some of the more important elements of that are that they no longer have a border, an aggressive white border, because the cutting process allows them to go for a full bleed card, which is to say that the art runs all the way to the edge of where the card is cut. They gave us a new background that looks a little bit like a book, which is interesting, but obviously a little jarring for those of us used to seeing our Game of Thrones cards. And they have a different template for each card type. So locations, characters, attachments, and events now look different and are more easily recognizable across the board. That's something that first edition didn't really have to the same extent in that the titles were always in the same place on cards. The layouts were much, much more similar. How do you feel about all that?
I think it's great, actually. I think the artwork is beautiful. I think they did a fantastic job. I think they took the time that was needed to make sure that it was done right, which is perfect.
I'm extremely happy with the art direction. I think that the templating for a lot of the factions, the color palette that they chose really looks very, very good. Whatever your favorite faction is, they're truer now to the books than they were before. For instance, Barra is now sort of gold with black rather than green, which was perfectly arbitrary in first edition. That, I think, is a very, very wise decision. And I think that overall, the art quality is much, much higher than the first core. There are a couple of cards where I'm not hugely satisfied with the art, but overall, I mean, it looks like Thrones. I will say there is one component thing that I feel is a little strange, though.
What's that?
So they introduced these new influence tokens, which yep. I can understand the justification for. I could even see them being introduced. So influence tokens are these generic tokens that are defined by card types. So we have power tokens, which is by accumulating 15, you win the game. We have gold tokens, which are what you use to buy cards. And now there are influence tokens, which are defined by card effects. These are generic tokens, which means that a card could call them stand tokens, a card can call them betrayal tokens, whatever, and it tells you how to work with them. So far, I'm with them. However, I feel like all of the instances in the core that they used them were gratuitous.
Okay.
There are things that you can do with influence tokens, with tokens like these, that make sense. you could track the passage of time. You could say every time your opponent draws a card, put a token on this, and it gets more strength for that. Or, you know, every time a character dies, put a token on this guy, and when he has four, he dies. You know, things right. to track the passage of time that way. But most of the ways they used it here, it simply wasn't necessary. It's just so you don't have to keep track of a limit once per round, which other cards are forcing you to do anyway, or that you don't have to remember something that happens until end of phase. And I have the feeling that what happened here is that they wanted the influence tokens for later mechanics and then realized that most of those mechanics were too complex for a core environment and said, we can't have these influence tokens that aren't used, so let's squeeze them in.
Let's force some way to use them.
And
yeah.
So they do feel a little forced, and I'm a little disappointed in the usage of those tokens.
Yeah, I mean, I look at the cards that use them, like the betrayal tokens on Jorah, and it's like, wouldn't that just have been as easy to say when he has X number of renown or power on him, force the power to be claimed? And yeah, I can see that.
However, some of the token use that they did add, I think, makes sense. And that's not the influence tokens, but the first player token, the Iron Throne token.
Yeah.
People were wondering when we first saw that the token spoiled, whether this was a dominance token, whether anything like that. Most of us have been playing without this for ages, and we think we do it fine. But I can remember quite a few games where I'm in the third or fourth phase of the game, and then I realize we didn't decide a first player, or I don't remember who's going first, especially at the end of a long tournament. I think that this is just a very simple quality of life addition, but I'm glad that they added this in.
I'm never going to use it, but you know.
You're never going to use it, no. Neither. I'm old dog. I won't be using that.
Can't help it.
Now, the game is coming out fairly soon, and hopefully will be followed up by new chapter packs and new cards very, very quickly. They've already announced the first two chapter packs, which suggests that they'll be coming out shortly. And I think that more so than any previous LCG or any other of the releases, it is important for them to push these out quickly. The reason being, you have to keep a fan base that is used to this huge, expansive card pool engaged and interested right off the top. With a card game like Conquest, you were attracting a new player base, so there wasn't the same expectation. Obviously, they wanted their card pool to grow, and it has now. But the fact that there was a little delay means that the people were getting a chance to learn these brand new rules. But there wasn't that those existing people who already basically knew the system and knew the potential of the system and were just waiting for it to reach that potential, like we have in Game of Thrones. So I think that makes a real strong push that they're going to have to get these new cards out quickly to market.
Yeah.
I guess the last thing that I really want to touch on is that some people in a lot of second editions and a lot of games have gone through reboots and relaunches. Is this, and I saw a forum post on the Fantasy Flight boards, a treacherous money grab? Is this just window dressing on the first edition? Is it a completely new game and it doesn't deserve the same name? Where does it stand on that spectrum?
It's probably a little of everything. So I think there is some new elements to the game. So I think it's definitely got an appeal from the old veteran players that are going to see new and interesting interactions, maybe some new mechanics, we hope. But at the same time, it's still got the base mechanics from the first game. It's definitely financially motivated. Like, we can't look at it and say it's not. So there's some money grab, but I think not in an extremely negative way, because the game needed the reboot for a whole bunch of the right reasons as well. So yeah, maybe it's got a little bit of all those things. It's definitely not the new game. Like, I would never classify it as a new game. It still uses those base mechanics, the plot, the characters, the three challenges, the things that make Game of Thrones Game of Thrones.
Do you think it hits the right balance of appealing to veterans and new players? Do you think it overcorrected?
I think the game is a lot of fun. If you're going to be playing casually, I definitely recommend it. If you're looking at playing competitively, I think it's not there yet, but I think it's going to be shortly. So if you're a competitive player and you're looking for the next competitive game, I say to you, come back in 6 months.
And I would say that the best aspect of the core set, and this is entirely, selling us and other things, of buying into this game is that you're buying into a community. You're buying into a community of absolutely great people that have been around in this game before. That's a sort of unique thing that you don't get when you're buying into any other new game, is that there's mm-hmm. this existing base. But also, this is the base of players that run their own un-Fantasy Flight, not Fantasy Flight supported tournaments where they print out their own custom prize support. They share it with people around the world. There is an unofficial tournament hosted in a medieval castle in Europe that is one of the biggest events out there that is absolutely fantastic. That the community, when we do show up to tournaments at Gen Con this year, for instance, where we were all here for the second edition release, a whole bunch of us were all in the same hotel after the big tournament. This is not a Magic competitive scene where, you know, people are wearing sunglasses and scarves to hide their faces and playing till, you know, for waiting for the slightest mistake and trying to crush the dreams of their opponents. You know, everybody goes out to the bar afterwards. The same thing happens at Worlds. This is a community that has
people sometimes let mistakes get taken back, everything. Like it's a very fun community and social, yeah.
And a lot of existing resources that you guys can tap in if you're buying into the game right now that carry over from the first edition. So, you know, community resources, websites, podcasts, and all that stuff that's already this sort of existing infrastructure. And I think that that's one of the very strong appeals of this, is that you're buying into a sure thing. The community is fantastic. There's no wild card there.
And there's a flip side to that. I mean, if you're one of these hyper-competitive Magic players, you're probably not going to find Thrones competitive enough for you. You know, people would frown, I would say, on, you know, that kill all comers attitude, because we're a much more open community in general.
All right. Well, I think that concludes our review of the core set. All right, Aaron. We desperately need a tiebreaker. So what we're going to do is we're going to build the deck on the episode. We don't need you for that, obviously. We're great dick builders. We know our shit. We
have no idea what we're doing. Did you say dick builder?
Dick builders. We're great dick builders. what we're going to do, and we're going to use you for, Aaron, is we're going to pitch three or four deck ideas, and then you're going to pick the one we're going to build on the cast. How does that sound?
Sure.
All right. So the first idea that I had was to build out of House Tyrell, High Garden, use two jousting contests and possibly a Game of Thrones, and build from there. Not sure what banner house will slot in best, but the idea is to sort of milk the fact that by only being able to declare one challenge, High Garden gives you a tremendous amount of control. All right, John, what was your first pitch?
I'm thinking a Lannister beatstick deck. Basically, you know, Tywin and Tyrion are just such monsters. We can get Tywin in there, get a couple different ways to generate lots of gold, and maybe get Hand of the King so he can stand up. He's got renown. He can participate in multiple challenges, get some kill events, and almost basically just Lannister with a bunch of neutral cards to protect him. You know, what the plot to discard attachments so they can't Milk of the Poppy him. And just play around this really big character that's really hard for your opponent to deal with, and just beat people in the face. He's got the right icons, that all-important green icon to stop the tears, and then you just have to worry. And the other great thing about Lannister, do this kind of like big beatstick character build, because they have the ability to cancel that Varys, which is so important in the Corset environment, where people, you know, Varys then marched to take out your big guy if you had some saves on him. So with Lannister, you can cancel that that trigger and just keep beatsticking.
So you're thinking a Lannister no agenda, basically, if you're talking of a bunch of neutrals, so you couldn't do the fealty.
Yeah, I mean, we would look at the number of neutral cards we'd end up putting in there. Maybe it would end up being fealty, if depending on the number of neutral. Maybe it wouldn't.
Yeah.
So I think Alex has another suggestion.
The other suggestion, yeah, we had a total of four that we were going to pitch. The other suggestion is to see how fast we can make a deck. I haven't seen Rush explored as a theme. It probably hasn't reached critical mass, but I'd like to push to see how quickly you can make a deck go. It would probably be Greyjoy involved, either as the banner faction or as the main faction, and just try maybe probably Tyrell as well because of the renown they can put on the board, and yeah, see whether it's possible to get maybe a turn 3 win out of that.
That sounds like Greyjoy Tyrell to me.
Yeah.
And then our fourth and final pitch, the Targaryen military-focused decks. Not the decks that are all built around Dany, which seems to be like the centerpiece that everyone does right away, but actually a deck that's more about Cal and getting maybe either Stark for their non-kneeling armies or Lannister for Jaime. You just get those multiple military challenges. You get a little bit of rush pressure if you use the Jaime way because you get the renown. And you can just, you know, you get a claim to turn, and you get two military challenges off. You can really start controlling some board. So I think that's worth investigating as well.
So look at that. We've got an aggro deck. a rush deck, a control deck, and a tower deck.
So I think I'm actually going to vote the aggro deck, because what I found is a lot of people are doing Targ to Lannister, but they're trying to do everything with it. They're trying to do all the Dany shenanigans with the High Clam stuff, and I feel like that's just a fool's errand. It's trying to do too much. I think the Simplify version of that, having that out there for people, would be very beneficial.
All right, we'll go with that. Thank you very much, Aaron.
My pleasure. Enjoy the cast.
So let's start with our host, Targaryen.
Yeah, it has to be Targaryen, because Khal Drogo himself is loyal, so we don't have much choice there. And again, the agenda. You had mentioned earlier that we could either flip this as Stark with the non-kneeling armies or with Jaime. I feel more comfortable with Jaime in that scenario. I think Jaime's probably a better bet, because there's a little more you get out of that banner.
All right. Well, let's talk about Khal. We need three of those, right?
We need three of those, and I think I will add our banner agenda as well, which is going to be Banner of the Lion.
Okay, I don't know how to do that, but...
Just type in the card name and it'll show up. So let's add three Jaime as well. I think he's a card that's not that hard to slot three of.
All right, are we gonna have some kill effects, like put to the sword? We are a military faction here.
We do, and I'm almost certain we will. I think we have to also include at least one, possibly two Tyrians.
Oh, yeah. Of course. We're Lannister anyways, right? Probably three.
Well, we'll start with three and see what happens there. Actually, do you want to work with the plots first? Because you did mention you wanted a fair bit of claim, too, and I think the plots might determine some other things about our deck.
Sure. We can take a look at that. So is Khal a lord?
Khal is, in fact, a lord. So we can use the Lord Reducing. One of the things, though, about this deck is if you want to play in a Naval Superiority safe way, you can potentially open with Sneak Attack, because you really only need that military challenge on the first turn, and you get 5 gold that is free of the interference of Naval Superiority.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. I think we'd probably end up putting Sneak Attack in there anyways.
Yeah, I think we certainly would. Wow, that's obviously the wrong plot. Great. Sneak Attack. Where is... other plots that can... That
Winds of Winter, the big Claim Tour that we're probably going to end up using, right?
Yeah, or Storm of Swords, which allows us to make a third military challenge, which could also be potentially kind of useful, as it can get us more renown off Jaime than a Claim 2 can.
Well, you know what we can do? We can run both.
We can. I don't know how many we want to, though. How many sort of claim to high pressure plots do you think this deck needs? Three or four?
Three.
So would you rather run two sneak attacks and a Storm of Swords?
Well, we can run a single sneak attack, a Winds of Winter, and a Storm of Swords, and still have our double if we need.
Okay. Let's start.
All right.
The Winter at one of. So that's three of our plots.
So we decided we're opening Sneak Attack. That's our big goal.
Well, I don't think obviously, I think we need to run March to the Wall as well, which will occasionally be an opener if someone sets up that, is forced to set up a single character that we can hit, or where we can differentiate that, because where we have the High Claim, March to the Wall can act as a finisher to take off the duped character or whoever's left at the end.
I think we need a summons in case we get unlucky. We don't get a Khal or a Jaime or anything to really get that going, right? Building around Khal, we probably need a way to find him if we have to.
Yeah. It's true that Khal has bad synergy with Sneak Attack, because we are not allowed to enable that second challenge.
Yeah.
But if we're only running the one and it tends to be our opener, I don't know how often we need that second challenge, or we're going to have Khal to start it up.
Well, the way I see it is if we don't have Khal, we're probably summoning, right? To get Khal. So we probably actually don't want Sneak Attack. We
so
probably
you want
a regular high...
Winter?
I think what we want to do is actually just run a high claim plot. A high gold plot that we could then open with if we have Khal in hand and just get two military challenges, bam, bam.
Because of that anti-synergy and the fact that we actually have some non-healers, I can see cutting the Sneak Attack then.
Yeah.
So we're back down to three plots, although at that point we probably do need to run two Winds of Winter.
I think we'll probably end up using two Winds of Winter, yeah. So two Winds of Winter, one Storm of Swords, one Marshed, one Summons. And we got two plot spots left, and we probably want a high gold something.
We certainly don't want the one that's that counts your opponent's characters, because we're hoping they will have very, very few.
Yeah.
We don't have a ton of March of the Wall and Storm of Swords are still reasonably high initiative. Noble Cause is a great plot, and that's probably what we want, given the distribution we have. So yeah. I would probably go with a Noble Cause, and then the Summons, that's our entire plot deck to start with.
We got a Noble Cause, March to the Wall, Storm of Swords, two Winds of Winter, and one Summons. That's only six plots.
That's only six, you're right.
We probably want the high gold one, the gold plot. Calling the Banners, is that it? Nine?
Do we want that when we're basically not running a lot of Ambush?
But we're not running a lot of events either.
Well, that depends. We don't actually know that yet. If we have Tyrion and we are pushing those military challenges.
Oh, what am I thinking? We want Confiscate. We want somewhere to get those milk off of our Khal Drogo.
Well, we do have Viserys, and we can run Rattleshirt's Raiders as well, because we want the military icons on the board. So we're not forced to run that.
But I think we just want it anyways. It's just such an easy answer to attachments in general, since attachments are so good right now.
But there's room for other stuff that also pushes our board presence fairly high, like Power Behind the Throne, which allows us to stand a character where when we can initiate more challenges than they can, being able to stand a character can be quite relevant.
Yeah.
There's also the safe Calm Over Westeros, which is a safe 5 gold opening that can't be hit by naval superiority and buys us some time to get set up if we need it.
All right, well, let's leave that one open. Let's get some of the cards, and we'll come back to it. How about that?
Okay. All right, yeah.
Let's look at our Targaryen cards.
Targaryen cards.
Or do you want to do Lannister first, because we have to do 14 or 12 or whatever it is?
That's a good idea. We'll start with Lannister.
Okay, I think we want a Joffrey because he's sexy.
We definitely want a Joffrey because he's sexy. Definitely want a Tickler because he's sexy. And we probably want a full play set of treacheries.
That's the cancel, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. We want at least two Tyrants.
Tyrion, you mean?
Tyrion, yeah.
Yeah. And
we probably want the Chudley Lannisport merchant.
Now, here's a question. We may want the Lannisport moneylender. Or the Lannisport merchant, possibly. Do we want Things I Do for Love? Now, we probably won't have the gold to do the big character bounce, but with the pressure we're putting, bouncing a Chud can mean that we wind up killing a big character. I don't know for sure. I think this is something that we could experiment with.
Yeah, let's throw one in, and we'll play around with it.
Okay.
We'll see if we have room for it later.
So that's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 Lannister cards without the Lannisport merchants. And you want to just put a pair of Lannisport merchants in there?
I think we do,
Yeah.
We might even want some Burnmen there. You know, being able to save that gold for a put to the sword and then switch it up and drop a Burnman could be nice.
I'd probably prefer the gold cloaks. They're the same ambush cost.
But they only stick around for one turn. But I guess the whole idea is to hold the board. Yeah, let's put in two gold cloaks.
Okay, so we're actually at 15 cards for Lanny right now.
Yeah, let's go down.
Kick that from there. Oh,
treachery requires
we have
Lannister.
To run a Widow's Wail. We have to run a Widow's Wail. It's just too good.
Okay. Treachery, though, requires that Lannister lord character, right? Or lady?
Treachery requires a unique Lanny character. We have the Tickler, we have Joffrey, we have two Tyrion, and three Jaime at the moment. Only other option that we can add.
Really? Maybe go down to two.
Okay, two treachery then. That's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. I'm still at 15 total Lannister.
Perfect.
We'll play from that. That's more than we need, but go with that. Within Targ, what do we need? The Dothraki Sea is actually a really potent card. I want to play at least two.
Sorry, what does it do again?
After you win a power challenge, you can sacrifice it to put a Dothraki character into play from your hand. At the end of the phase, return that character to your hand. it's a way to cheat in Khaldrogo when you couldn't afford him, still get that second military challenge. He comes back to hand where he's fairly safe.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, there aren't that many Dothraki. We could run the Braided Warrior, and we can run Khaldrogo, and that's it.
Well, I mean, Braided Warrior is solid for 2 for 3 anyways, so I can see running a full playset since we're about military challenges.
I think it also gives us a target we can attach the Arrak to. But maybe we don't need 3 to Thraki C, and maybe we don't even need 2.
I don't think we run the Thraki C, sadly.
All right, well, we'll see. I do think we probably run one of each of the dragons. They're scary to your opponent, and they're good. Obviously, probably 2 Jorahs and a Viserion.
Yes, definitely 2 Jorahs. We need the 3 Targaryen Loyalists.
We need 3 Targaryen Loyalists. We need 3 Illyria's Estate.
Do we want to run Illyria's Estate?
As a reducer?
It's a limited. And we're probably going to run 3 Rose Roads and 3... So I guess we don't take the Rose Roads.
I think we take the Rose Roads. I think we're probably running 9 limited.
I'm not sure. Do we take the Rose Roads? Like we go King's Road, Estate, and Rose Roads? And run 9 limited?
Yeah. Probably. Right. We might cut one of those depending on how it goes, but I think we're probably running between 8 and 9. At this point, I just feel like it's almost necessary. Now, I've added I'm definitely going to add a Viserys. Viserys has the attachment discard when he leaves play, which again is for a one cost local character. He's great.
All right. Yes, he is great. We will take one.
Now, we also have the option to use Waking the Dragon, which can get us another challenge out of someone important. I think that's not a terrible idea. It is a zero cost stand that then eventually costs you the character, but I think when we need to push 3 challenges, that's not bad.
Are we going to run more dragons and run Dracarys or no?
Dracarys? I don't think so.
Okay, so Dracarys is just too super powerful effect.
But we're not running Dany either, which gives us one less target to boot. Yeah. And I'm not sure if we're running the recycled events for the dragons. Okay. Maybe, but I don't think so.
Okay, so that means we leave the Pals of Punishment out of this too. We're just all about that military challenge.
I think let's try that and see how it works. And I think it probably will.
All right.
So the question is, Waking the Dragon at the moment, and I'd be tempted to put 2 of those in. Worst case scenario, you're using it to stand a character that's going to die that phase anyway to a military challenge, and it buys you, you know, something.
Yeah, it's all right. We have no other renown, right?
Well, we've got Jorah, which is at least 2 of, and Khaldrogo himself. I don't know. I'm tempted to use it.
All right, let's 1 or 2.
At the moment I have 2, that may be not a good idea. I don't know. We'll still need room for a fair few uniques. There is one more card I'd like to put in here, and that's Drogo's Arrak. We have Dothraki targets for it. It's just a strength boost on some of them. But on Khaldrogo, obviously, it's huge.
Yeah.
So I think it's probably a 2 of.
I could agree with that.
So currently I'm looking at 4 attachments. Oh, no, 3 attachments.
I have 6 attachments. Sorry, I have 5 attachments. 1 Widow Will, 2 Jerkers, or 2 Bodyguard.
Oh, you've already added neutrals. Hey, no, we haven't gotten there.
We're on to neutral.
We probably are. I'm having another look as to a couple other options, but I honestly think Fire and Blood can get us someone back because we do have the hatchlings so I could put them into play, and it can cycle Drogo back into the deck so he didn't get heads on spikes. I don't know how key he is to our strategy and whether he's to run a Fire and Blood.
Mm-hmm.
Nah.
I think I agree with you.
We'll protect him with bodyguards and stuff.
Okay. Well, bodyguards don't protect from heads on spikes, but
yeah.
So be it. Okay, so let us go on to neutrals then, and let's take off the filter for loyalty. I don't know how that works. Bodyguards are...
Let's do our locations. King's Road, Rose Road. Bam, we're up to 9.
Okay, King's Road's 3, and Rose Road's 3. We're up to 9, and that's probably all we want out of there for locations.
Yeah.
Now, I would like to get Rattleshirt's Raiders in. I like them a lot for a couple of reasons. One, they're extra military icons for us, which is what our deck is trying to do anyway. Two, they can strip bodyguards before claim. So they actually put a fair bit of pressure on your opponent. And they act as more attachment control that we can use in general. So I think we can get away without running filthy accusations.
That's possible. All right, so you want...
I would like at least 2 Rattleshirt's Raiders.
They're 4/3 monocon.
They're 4/3, but they really do. Essentially, sometimes they make it claim 2 by stripping a bodyguard.
All right, well, why don't we run 3, go all out on them, and then we can run the Wildling Horde.
Do we have anything else that kneels our faction card? We have Things I Do for Love, but not that. So the Wildling Horde is extremely efficient and expensive. Can we afford it?
It's 5/5. We can probably run a Wildling Horde if we're going to run a Raiders.
Okay. I'm up for that, for a Wildling Horde. You want to run 1 or 2?
Probably 2.
2 brings us up to 31 characters, which sounds like a reasonable place to be.
Though we'd probably want a little finger.
Yeah.
Maybe 2 little fingers.
2 little fingers sounds like a good idea to me.
Okay.
Now,
so 33 characters.
Find him. Apparently he doesn't show up in here. You'd imagine he'd be under L. Well, there he is, under L. Who'd have thought?
Crazy.
2 little fingers puts us to 33 characters, which I'm also quite okay with.
Now, I have a question for you.
All right. So you had added bodyguards. You're a big fan of these.
You're not a fan of bodyguard?
Well, I'm not a fan of getting them stripped off from Reaver, but I think... We need an answer to Tears of List, and that has to be either Bodyguard or Hand's Judgment or both.
Yeah.
And so I do agree. In that case, I think we need some way to keep Drogo himself on the board.
Yeah.
So I'm not opposed to Bodyguard, and I'm not opposed to 2 copies of it.
Perfect. We are in agreement. Now, I know we're going to run Put to the Sword.
Yes. I think we may also run Put to the Torch.
That is the question I was going to ask. Like, I think controlling their economy so they can't get back in the game is worth a lot.
I think it is worth a lot when we can pressure away their Chud and things like that, and then they just can't play enough to protect their big characters.
All right. 3 it is. You convinced me.
3 of each?
Yep.
And that puts us at 58 cards. And 11 events, 9 locations, 5 attachments, and 33 characters. Oh, yeah. That's not too bad.
So what are we going to do with those last 3 deck spots?
I got 2 deck spots.
You have 2.
And a quad. I'm running 11 events.
I'm running 10 events. 3 Put to the Sword, 2 Treachery, 1 Things I Do for Love, 1 Waking the Dragon, 3 Put to the Torch.
Oh, I have 2 Waking the Dragon.
Do we think it's that good? You barely convinced me to put it in.
Do we think it's that good? What's it going to stand for us? A Viserys, and then trigger him, which isn't great. Any of the dragons could potentially stand, which can scare people, but it won't do that much damage. Jorah, obviously, is a great candidate for it. Braided Warrior is not unique. Khal Drogo is the biggest target. Okay, let's stick with 1 and see how it plays out in practice. I think we'll occasionally get
some. Do we want some little birds? Do we care about intrigue icons, or are we just going to go all in on this, like smash people in the face with our military and hope we can wipe their board?
We have intrigue icons. We have Viserion, and we have the Tickler, and we have Jorah.
Yeah.
So if we need
Dragon,
to
Regal.
Put the pressure there, that's right, and we have Tyrion. So if we need the pressure there, I think we can probably justify it. So I don't think that's a disaster.
I feel like we should go up a 3 Tyrion. It's just so good to generate that extra gold during the challenge phase.
Yeah.
Unlimited card.
All right, let's go with 3 Tyrion for the moment. And so, and we did add those two.
Go to 3 Lannisport merchants then. Just anything to reduce things is good. And now we have one. I have one spot left after that.
Okay, one precious spot for something cool.
Yeah.
A single hands judgment, or is our 10 events already?
I think we're pushing our events already.
Okay.
Something cheap. Maybe just a burn man from Lannister, another ambushed military icon.
That really the best we can do with that.
We could run one of the Lannister intrigue guys that give us the gold.
We could run a Milk of the Poppy.
I hear milks are good. Let's throw a milk.
I mean, our goal is to kill the character.
Yeah.
But
we could run our own tiers. Just one.
No, we can barely. I mean, we could, but we don't. We can't reliably win that.
I think it'd be good to have in the deck. People would, like, once we played a few times against someone or, you know, in a tournament setting, then they would know that the tiers are in there and they have to always block all our intrigue challenges.
But the thing is, we have to do the military first, and they're going to leave their best character up after that. And for
why would we have to do the military first?
Because otherwise they choose that character for claim.
Right, yeah, so we military, and then we tiers.
And then the character they probably have left is likely to have an intrigue icon. In a lot of these houses. No? You don't think that's the case?
No, I agree. I think you're right. All right, no tears.
No tears. Cry
that
you
might. Throw a seal of the hand in. I love that card, by the way. 3 cost, I know, but it's huge. Being able to stand that Khal Drogo an extra time, get in the military challenge, get that renown. It's
fun. What else? We can only put it on lords and ladies, right?
Yeah. So Jamie.
So that's Khal, Jamie, Tyrion, Joffrey, and Viserys.
I like that, but it might not be right for our deck.
I mean...
I'm going to drop in the Burn Man. Bam.
You're going to drop in the Burn Man over all the awesome other stuff we could put in there?
Name it.
That list is huge. I know. That list is huge. Now,
so hard to decide I'm going to put a Burn Man in.
No. That's silly. Don't do that.
Okay, well what?
You really want a Burn Man over a 3rd Gold Cloaks?
No. I want the 3rd Gold Cloaks. I forgot that we were only running.
Yeah, let's try the 3rd.
Now, the Burn Men are better for setup, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
6 and 2. Are we going to have a problem with setups?
Well, I don't think
Steve,
it really
is our high end is 6s, and we want a 2nd character. We have Drogon, Viserion. 3 loyalists and 3 Lannisport merchants. How often are we going to set that up? We may have to play with that to get a 2nd character on setup. We're just as likely to get Littlefinger or Wildling Horde at 5, and then we can put a 3. No, I'm okay with this as a starting point. Now, we still have a very, very valuable plot slot.
Yeah.
At the moment. We're running 2 Winds of Winter. We're running 1 Storm of Swords. Those are and a March to the Wall. That's our aggro module. We're running a Summons and a Noble Cause, and we're actually running 4 attachment control cards in the deck. I think we can get away without running our least favorite there.
Yep.
I would be tempted to try Power Behind the Throne.
Really?
I think there's a fair bit of Neil out there right now. And that does put a crimp in us if Jamie, for instance, gets knelt. He can't participate in the 2 challenges.
That's why that friggin' 3-cost attachment's so good.
It is, but the 3-cost attachments cost 3. Well, this is a plot we can use on demand for the turn.
It's only got 3 gold.
It does only have 3 gold. We have a 2 fours.
I love that 9 gold plot, man, for late game. A little bit of comeback, someone gets a Pharos off, and we just, like, 9 gold it. I think gold is one of the key...
6 of the cards we can play with it. We run no draw at all. That's another consideration. We could run counting coppers.
We can also run like a Feast for Crows. Because we're going to be keeping their board wiped and our guys don't kneel that often, you think that we could actually gain that little extra power from winning dominance, and 6 gold is nothing to laugh at.
And given that we have very little draw, that 4 reserve might not hurt us all that much.
That's basically what I was thinking.
Draw is our biggest weakness, but, I mean, we have to pressure early and try this as an aggro deck, so let us try it as an aggro deck, and I'm okay with trying that as a closer.
Alright.
I think we will have problems with Vera, though. I think that Feast for Crows may have to swap in for the Stand Plot at some point.
And Gold Curve is so bad.
Well, let's try it. What do they call it again? So how do I say this deck? So my concerns with this deck is obviously that if we have to use summons on turn one, that we might just be too slow. We might allow enough of a board presence to creep up that we just cannot handle the...
Well, here's the problem with that. Winds of Winter is only 3 gold. Storm of Swords is only 3 gold. We cannot open with either of these two plots. We are opening with a Noble Cause 90% of the time, hoping to get 2 military challenges and then bring the pressure. So our deck really is all based around that beautiful Khal Drogo. So if we don't see him, that can cause some serious problems. So I think we have to keep the summons, whether it slows us down.
I agree.
And when they Tears of Lissim him, which they will, we will cry, and that'll be the game. I believe we built an okay deck, but not a good one on this cast, Alex. Our friend Aaron picked a bad archetype. And, I mean, we had to stick with what he picked, listeners, but we just want to say it was the white book that took you down this path. I think we had an excellent idea with your Tyrell control-y build. I think my Lannister Beach Stick deck is one of the best decks in the meta. I mean, the white book just took us down this path of a good deck, just not as great as the others could have been. We'll have to build another deck next episode.
The point was to guide people through our thought process in working through this. I think where we failed was probably in explaining what all the individual cards do for those who are not intimately familiar with them yet, which is probably a large portion of our audience. I think that there are some cards that we'll want to look at and see how they're working for us, and that includes things like The Things I Do for Love, which I think has some potential, but we have to see how effective it's actually working out to be in stripping out Chuds so that we can finish them off with the military claim.
Waking the Dragon.
Waking the Dragon, which I suspect we may wind up cutting depending on how much mileage we get out of it. We may need to build in something to keep Khal Drogo alive and not getting hit by Heads on Spikes, for instance. Something like the Fire and Blood, just to be able to shuffle him back into the deck. Although, who knows? I think the deck can win without Khal Drogo. We can still put Claim 2 military challenges reliably and use our events to put pressure on their board. But the lack of Wildfire means that if we fall behind, we're not going to keep up.
Yeah, we can't fall behind with the deck. And on top of that, because our plots have such low gold at 3, that's basically our put to the sword. So if we don't have Tyrion Lannister on, we're not really marshalling after that first round. We're hoping that we have a superior board presence that we can then maintain through military claim going forward in our events.
Yeah, I mean, not really marshalling. That depends on our reducer base, which is reasonably strong. But
we might want to look at, instead of the Marched, which I know is a good pressure plot, running that 9-golder. Because that 9-golder, man, I'm telling you, a lot of my decks, I just have 2 of those in there. Because that's like just the cream. Because I think the most important thing on plots right now is gold.
All right, tell you what. Let's kill the power behind the throne and add in the 9-golder.
Oh, okay. That does make me feel better inside.
Okay.
I mean, Khal Drogo is still doing his work when he's knelt.
Yep, he is.
He's letting us get those military.
I'm not worried about people kneeling Khal Drogo. I just don't like them kneeling Jaime. That costs us 2 challenges. Sometimes 3.
I think marching orders is definitely a most excellent plot.
Okay. All right.
Then with that and Noble Cause, I feel a little bit better about our overall curve.
Sure.
And I feel, honestly, like for the listeners, that a Marching Order and a Noble Cause, those two plots probably appear in every single deck. I think they're almost auto-includes in my mind because the gold curve in this this core set is so based on that limited economy. It's so hard to play cards, and really that gold is super important. Now, I know some people are trying to, you know, blockade people turn one, but even if you get your Noble Cause blockaded, its text is still working. You're still reducing that lady or lord character. If you got some chief lady and lords like Joffrey, the Tickler, etc.,
then you can still not a lord.
Okay, well, like Joffrey, you can still drop those into play. So it depends on your hand and when you want to open. But I see these as mid game plots in a lot of decks, and they just let you spill at the door board after a wildfire or something.
Now, I agree, but I'm not sold on Marching Orders. I find that negative text is huge, and unless I think that giving up even being able to bluff having something like Dracarys, or even being able to bluff having something like Put the Sword, is a huge loss. I think that not being able to play locations also tends to be quite crippling. You wind up with more limiteds locking up your hand eventually over time. I think the four reserve is a constraint, even though the nine gold lets you play a few more characters. But really, I feel like Marching Orders is a great plot where you can ambush things. If you can ambush things, then you haven't lost all your challenge tricks, and your opponent can still be kept off balance, because that's not marshalling locations, attachments, or play events. And we do have some ambush, so maybe we can get away with it.
Gold cloaks, we got Widow's Wail, we have some ambush. And on top of that, I don't see it as an opener. I think you play out your economy.
Oh, yeah, you definitely, I don't see this as an opener.
Okay. This is our recovery. You know, things aren't going well. First turn didn't go super great. We tried Noble Cause. We had to summon for Cal. And now we got to play out our hand. And this is how we do it.
All right, John, closing comments. I got nothing.
Nothing.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.
All right. What's talk?
Oh, that's table of contents.
Okay. I was just making sure it wasn't something else.